thinking. Margot used the remote to mute the TV. This is really fucked.
Yeah, he said.
Over 300 people are dead. Almost 1,000 are injured. Why would our own government do that?
I don't know, Ian said.
It didn't come up in your brainstorming sessions?
We were thinking up attacks the terrorists might carry out against us, Ian said. Not our own government.
We need to go to the police.
We can't.
Why not?
We're up against the CIA, Ian said. But why stop there? The Pentagon and the White House could be involved too. If we walk into a police station, I guarantee you that we'll be found dead the next morning, even if we were in protective custody.
You can't guarantee that because you don't know shit about what the CIA can or can't do. You're a writer. You make stuff up.
That's right. But here's what I do know. They were able to crash an airplane into Waikiki by remote control. They knew exactly where we were. They were watching us every second. They were able to locate a car with autopilot, hack it, and try to run me over with it. That tells me that they can reach us and kill us anywhere.
That means we aren't safe no matter where we go, she said. So unless you come up with a better alternative by morning, I'll take my chances with the police. At least I'll be surrounded by men with guns.
And they could be pointed at you, Ian thought. But he didn't say that. She was right. He needed a survival plan, and he didn't have one yet. I'm sorry I got you involved in this, he said. Margot got up without acknowledging the apology.
The dogs have been fed. They'll want to go out again. You'll have to handle that. I'm going to bed.
Sweet dreams, Ian said.
Yeah, like that's going to happen.
She trudged out of the room. Chapter 17. Seattle's fleet of metro buses were equipped with security cameras that recorded 8 hours of video onto a hard drive. The video was automatically uploaded to the server when the buses returned to the transit yard for gas or service. That's why it wasn't until about 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time that the video showing Ian and Margot riding the bus from downtown to Laurelhurst landed on the server. It was another 45 minutes before the video was swept up by Blackthorn's search bot and sifted by their facial recognition system. The instant the system identified Ian and Margot, a screen grab appeared on the media wall in the Situation Room, accompanied by a shrill alert beep that got everyone's attention. Things moved swiftly after that. The Blackthorn operatives remotely accessed the footage recorded that day by cameras at University Village, Burgermaster, the Center for Urban Horticulture, and other businesses near the bus stop on Northeast 45th Street. Using that video, they were able to visually track Ian and Margot as they walked to Northeast 41st Street, but lost sight of them once the pair was in the residential neighborhood. But that was only a temporary setback. Seth searched the recent incoming calls to Margot's cell phone and uncovered one from Sam Barber, the owner of a maritime shipping company who lived in Laurelhurst, owned 2 dogs, and was presently in Beijing with his wife. He figured Margot had to be their dog sitter. It was an easy assumption to confirm. The Barbers had an alarm system that was monitored by a subsidiary of Blackthorn. A review of the Barbers' activity logs showed that someone opened the front door and entered the alarm deactivation code 10 minutes after Blackthorn lost visual surveillance of Ian and Margot. Shortly after 4 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, Victoria called Wilton Cross, who was sleeping in his office apartment, to let him know that the targets had been located. The assassin was staying at a Red Roof Inn, 2 blocks from the rental car terminal and across the street from a cemetery, in a ground floor room with a view of a gas station. When she'd arrived that afternoon, she removed her glasses, blue-colored contact lenses, and brown wig, stripped off her dull gray pantsuit, and unwound the ace bandages that she'd wrapped around her chest to flatten her breasts. The assassin was now a short-haired, busty blonde with green eyes. She yanked the filthy comforter and blanket off the double bed and rested naked on the clean white sheets to wait for instructions. They didn't come until late that night. Her throwaway phone vibrated on the nightstand. She picked it up and checked the message screen. It was a text with DMV photos of Ian Ludlow and Margot French, and a hyperlinked Seattle address. She tapped the address, and a satellite map came up with a targeting dot on the location. It was a lakefront home on East Laurelhurst Drive. She picked up her suitcase, unpacked the black jogging suit, and got dressed to kill. Ian spent the night on the couch, drinking Johnny Walker from the bottle, eating cashews from a huge Costco jar, and watching reruns of old TV shows, seeking comfort and safety in the company of his good friends Thomas Magnum, Joe Mannix, and Walker Texas Ranger. Those were guys who knew how to handle problems. So was Clint Straker, and so were Hollywood and the Vine, and every other character that Ian wrote about. So why was he having such a hard time figuring out what to do next? If he could come up with crime stories for a man who was half plant, surely he could think of something he could do to outwit his opponents. Thinking about Hollywood and the Vine actually gave him an idea, one that might help them survive, but probably wouldn't convince Margot not to go to the police. Still, at least now he knew what to do in the morning, but that was still a few hours away. That's when one of the dogs nudged his good arm with her wet nose and whined at him while the other dog scratched the French door. How long had they been asking to go out? He set the half-empty bottle of Johnny Walker and the jar of nuts on the coffee table, got up on shaky legs, and opened the French door for the dogs. At the same instant that Ian opened the door, another door opened at the back of the kitchen. The assassin slipped into the house from the side yard, unnoticed by man or beast. She casually selected a knife from a wooden knife block on the counter and crept up behind Ian, who stood at the open French door, his back to her. This would be easier than killing a fly. Ian started to close the French door when he saw a reflection in one of the window panes and screamed. He saw a woman behind him, raising a knife to his throat. He whirled around to face her, instinctively bringing up his right arm, the one in a cast, to protect himself. Her blade raked the cast as he clumsily backed away from her, still screaming. The assassin advanced, swinging and thrusting the knife. He blocked her repeatedly with his cast, the blade stabbing through the plaster, chipping away at it. She was smiling the whole time, and he realized, to his horror, that the only reason he was still alive was because she was amused by his ridiculous attempts at self-defense. But she was getting tired of it. She kicked his legs out from under him. He fell onto the coffee table, and she came in for the kill. He grabbed the whiskey bottle by the neck with his good hand and swung it at her head. She raised her arm to block the blow. The bottle smashed against her arm, cutting her and splashing them both with whiskey. Her eyes became ice cold, and he knew he was going to die. Ian's screams brought Margot running into the kitchen while he was still fighting off the assassin. She grabbed two frying pans, one in each hand from the overhead rack, and charged into the family room. The assassin turned away from Ian just as Margot swung a frying pan at her head. The assassin dodged the pan and thrust her knife at Margot, who blocked it with the other frying pan. Now the assassin directed her fury at Margot, leaving Ian behind. Margot deflected the assassin's knife attacks with the frying pans. But the assassin kept coming, with increasing speed and ferocity, forcing Margot back against the cooking island. In a second, Ian was certain that Margot would be pinned and killed. Ian got to his feet, grabbed a fireplace poker, and charged the assassin. She sensed him coming and seemed more irritated than threatened. She turned to face him just as the two golden retrievers came bounding back into the house, right across Ian's path. Ian tripped over the dogs and flew forward, straight into the assassin, driving the poker into her stomach with the force of his full body weight. Her body made a moist, sucking sound as she was gored, and he felt the sickening, gelatinous sensation of her flesh being penetrated. He let go of the poker and scrambled away. The assassin stared at him with profound disbelief, blood spilling out of her belly, and toppled to the floor. Chapter 18. An excerpt from Death Benefits by Ian Ludlow. The barbecue joint was on a desolate highway in a forgotten corner of Texas. The only sign was a piece of warped, cracked plywood with the three letters BBQ painted in faded red. There were no posted hours. The shack began serving when the meat was ready and closed when the meat was gone. The cinder block and corrugated metal shack was filled with smoke from the pits out back, where racks of ribs and brisket were barbecued to perfection. The pitmaster was an ancient black man, his face weathered from decades spent leaning into the heat and smoke, his stained apron the painted history of Texas barbecue. The pitmaster lived in a double-wide behind the shack. The meat was his life. Straker was the only customer. He sat at one of the two long wooden picnic tables, each covered with throwaway red checkerboard tablecloths. He took a fork and a knife from the mason jar full of cutlery in the center of the table and set them on the white paper napkin beside his bottle of beer. The waitress came out with a plate of pork ribs, a bowl of beans, and a piece of homemade bread that was torn from the loaf with her bare hands. She was a middle-aged white woman with big cheeks, front and rear, and a clean apron. "I hope the ribs taste as good as they smell," Straker said. "Even better, honey." She gestured to the three squeeze bottles on the table, each a different shade of red. "Those are the sauces. Original, spicy, and melt your fucking face off." Straker reached for the melt your fucking face off, slathered a rib with it, and took a bite. The waitress watched for the agonized reaction and got none. She was bewildered. "It's mighty tasty," Straker said. "But I have toothpaste with more kick." "I must have put the wrong sauce in the bottle." She squeezed a drop of the melt your fucking face off onto her fingertip, licked it, and instantly winced with pain. "What do you brush your teeth with, lye?" Before he could answer, three big shit kickers carrying baseball bats stepped into the joint. They wore sleeveless shirts and tank tops that showed off their prison tats and jailhouse muscles. One stood at the door while the other two approached Straker. The waitress stepped away from the table, but Straker concentrated on eating his first rib. "We come to teach you a lesson, boy," Shitkicker number one said, standing to Straker's right. "It's we've come," Straker said. "Now I've just taught you a lesson."
"Get up, asshole,"
Shitkicker number two said, standing to Straker's left. "I'm eating lunch." Straker finished his first rib and set down the clean bone. "Wait outside, and you can frighten me when I'm done."
"We ain't gonna frighten you, boy,"
Shitkicker number three said from his spot at the door.
"We're gonna beat the shit out of you."
"Then I suggest you call for some more men while you're waiting," Straker said, reaching for the squeeze bottle of melt your fucking face off.
"There's three of us and one of you,"
Shitkicker number one said.
"You're outnumbered."
Straker squirted the sauce into Shitkicker number one's face. He didn't melt the man's face off, but he screamed in pain and reached for his eyes. Straker grabbed the top of Shitkicker number one's bat with both hands and jammed the handle deep into the man's gut. Shitkicker number one doubled over and dropped to the floor, banging his head on the edge of the table as he went down. Straker set the bat on the bench. Shitkicker number two charged, bat above his head. Straker whirled around and threw his fork at him like it was a dagger. The fork plunged deep into Shitkicker number two's throat. The man instinctively grabbed for the fork and dropped his bat. Straker caught the bat, rammed Shitkicker number two in the balls with it, and then set it on the bench too. Shitkicker number two hit the floor, curled up in agony beside his friend. Straker hadn't moved from his seat or disturbed his plate. He looked at the shitkicker who stood at the door and said,
"Can I finish my lunch now?"
"Yeah, sure,"
the man stammered and walked out the door. Straker put some sauce on his ribs, had a sip of his beer, and got back to eating, paying no attention to the two men on the floor as they struggled to their feet and staggered out of the place. They left their bats behind. The waitress came over and set a thick slice of pecan pie on the table. "We're gonna have to rename our hot sauce."
"Why's that?" Straker asked.
"Billy Bob may be blind for life, but he still got his face," she said. "You have any suggestions?"
Straker wiped his lips with his napkin. "The Ass Kicker."
Chapter 19. The assassin's death was agonizing and ugly. Blood gushed out of her belly and bubbled up out of her mouth. She gurgled, and her body twitched. Her bladder and bowels emptied with a noisy splurt and a revolting stench. The next instant, she was suddenly as still and lifeless as a rock. This was a real death, unlike anything Ian had ever seen, because he'd seen only fictional death before. But now that she was dead, he slowly became aware of his own trembling, of the dogs cowering behind the couch, and of Margot beside him, staring numbly at the body and holding a pan in each hand, prepared for more battle. Ian gently touched Margot's hand, snapping her out of her stare.
"I don't think you need those anymore," he said.
Margot became aware of herself and hung the scratched and dented pans back on the rack.
"That's the second time you saved my life," he said.
Margot shook her head.
"We saved each other."
An actual professional assassin had tried to kill them both, and he'd killed her instead. It was unbelievable. But there she was, right in front of him. He could see her and smell her. Somehow seeing an actual killer, especially a dead one lying on the floor in front of him, made the danger more visceral. It was one thing to have a car trying to run him over, but quite another to see the threat against him in the flesh. He looked a killer in the eye this time, not a camera lens. The threat against him was amorphous before. Now it was human. But who was this killer? Where did she come from, and how did she find them? One of the dogs, feeling emboldened, inched forward to sniff at the blood. Margot grabbed the dog by the collar and pulled him back.
"No, no, no. Stay away from the dead psychopath."
"You should get the dogs out of here," Ian said, "and keep them out."
"Yeah, that's a good idea."
Margot hustled the dogs out of the kitchen into the dining room and closed the doors, then came back in and closed the French doors leading outside. While she did that, Ian went to the sink, put a rubber dish glove on his left hand, and crouched beside the assassin's body, careful not to get blood or anything else on his shoes. He reached out with his left hand and began easing a fanny pack out from under her body, wincing as he did it and breathing through his mouth to avoid the stink. Margot squatted beside him, grimacing at the gore.
"What are you doing?"
"I saw this fanny pack on her when she went after you. I want to see what she's got inside. Maybe we can learn something about who she was and how she found us."
He unzipped the bloody pack, holding it at arm's length, and carefully removed a rental car key fob, a lockpick, and a disposable cell phone. He stood up, flipped the phone open, and showed Margot what was on the message screen. His hand was shaking, so she had to grab his wrist to steady the phone while she looked at the display. She saw pictures of the two of them, and the address of the house.
"How did they find us?" she asked.
"I don't know," he said. "But I'm going to try to buy us some time."
He took off his glove and typed a two-word text back to whoever had sent the photos and address. "It's done." Blackthorn Global Security Headquarters, Bethesda, Maryland, July 19th, 5:17 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Victoria was half asleep on the vinyl couch in the employee break room, her phone clutched in her hand, her head on the hard armrest. Her phone vibrated, waking her up. She opened her eyes and squinted at her text screen.
It's done. She smiled. About fucking time. Seattle, Washington, July 19th, 2:18 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Ian powered off the phone the instant he got the delivered tag on the text message. He went to the sink and dropped the phone into the disposal. Margot followed him. What was the point of that?
I've either convinced them we're dead, or did something so outside of their regular protocol that they'll know we're still alive.
Ian ran the faucet and turned on the disposal. It chewed the phone with a labored grinding and then jammed up with a mechanical whine. He turned off the disposal and shut off the water.
Either way, I hope it bought us a few hours.
To do what?
Run, he said.
He started for the door that led to the entry hall.
Wait,
Margot gestured to the assassin. Aren't we going to clean this up?
Hell no. We need to get as far away from here as we can. We don't have time to waste.
He opened the door, careful not to let the dogs in.
Are you coming?
She nodded and walked out with him.
I'm going to get a terrible review on Yelp.
It was a funny thing to say, and he found it reassuring because it told him several important things. One, she was a fighter. Two, she had her shit together. Three, she was going to stay with him and not go running to the police. Four, she understood they were both fucked.
They're dead,
Victoria called Cross, waking him up for a second time that night to tell him the news.
Finally, Cross said.
He hung up the phone, settled back into the sumptuous bed in his office apartment, and thought about what he'd done and what was yet to come. From an operational standpoint, he was glad that Ludlow and French were dead. But he took no pleasure in killing them or the hundreds of people in Honolulu. They were all innocent civilians. But it had to be done for the greater good. He considered himself a patriot, and for years it had sickened and disturbed him to see the CIA's resources and abilities decay due to bureaucratic incompetence, political cowardice, and public apathy, while the terrorist threat to America intensified. On top of that, the agency was crippled by ridiculous legal restrictions imposed on it by people more concerned with privacy and civil liberties than with the survival of the country. The answer was obvious to Cross. Give the CIA's job to Blackthorne. They had the technology, the people, and the freedom to do it right. But it wouldn't happen through politics as usual. The biggest hurdles wouldn't be getting the public to agree to the outsourcing of the CIA's key responsibilities to Blackthorne, or dramatically limiting the government's oversight into their activities. It would be repealing all of the laws and international treaties that stood in the way of America doing its necessary spying, stealing, and killing effectively. To make it happen, Cross used history as his guide. It had taken 9/11 to get the Patriot Act passed, and with it the sweeping relaxation of civil liberties that gave domestic law enforcement agencies the broad and deeply intrusive surveillance powers they'd sought for decades. It also made the government secretly eager to go far beyond that, at least until Edward Snowden ruined things. Cross knew it would take another attack, one that terrified the public and outraged politicians, to expose the CIA's incompetence and give the president the moral imperative to give Blackthorne the nation's covert operations, free of any legal or bureaucratic restraints. Ludlow came up with the idea of the plane crash and how to do it. But it was Cross who refined the plan and targeted Hawaii, so it would echo back in the nation's consciousness to 9/11 and Pearl Harbor. Cross had crashed that plane for the good of the country. And yes, for the money it would bring to Blackthorne. He didn't think the windfall profits clashed with his patriotic motivations. Blackthorne would spend the money better and more productively for the security of the nation than the CIA would. And why shouldn't he and the people who worked for Blackthorne be generously compensated for the hazardous duty they undertook, personal sacrifices they made, and emotional burdens they endured on behalf of their country? No one deserved that compensation more than he.
the man ultimately responsible for the deaths of hundreds of innocent men, women, and children. He'd need all the luxuries and indulgences money could buy to help him live with that. Not that he had any regrets about doing it. The dead were patriots who'd sacrificed their lives for the future safety and prosperity of their families and their country. In his business, he firmly believed the ends justify the means. But when he pulled up his sheets, laid his face on his soft pillow, and tried to imagine those nuble nymphs sewing his Egyptian sheets, the only faces that came to his mind were those of the screaming passengers of Trans-American 976. It only proved to him how much he deserved all of that money. Chapter 20. Seattle, Washington, July 19th, 2:20 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. "Your cast is falling apart," Margot said as they walked out of the kitchen. "Come with me." Ian looked at his right arm. The cast was crumbling, riddled with gashes from the knife and barely hanging together. Some of the gauze underneath the plaster was bloodstained where the assassin's knife had pierced his skin. He didn't think any of the cuts were very deep, but even if they were, the cast would probably be an adequate bandage. He based that on the medical knowledge he'd gained from watching Dr. Dick Van Dyke on Diagnosis, Murder. She led him to the laundry room, which was the size of a one-bedroom apartment, and fitted with the same custom cabinetry as the kitchen. In addition to a high-end washer and dryer, there was also a steam press, an ironing station, a sewing station, and other equipment that Ian assumed was for dry cleaning. There was a center island for folding laundry, with a wide roll of tissue paper on a dispenser at one end. Margot sat him down on a stool at the island, opened one of the nearby cabinets, and pulled out a roll of duct tape and a pair of scissors. "How many people live in this house?" Ian said. She sat down next to him and began wrapping silver duct tape tightly around his cast. "Just the two of them. 8 people, tops, when their kids, their spouses, and the grandchildren stay over." Ian shook his head. "They could start a business out of this room, doing laundry for the entire neighborhood." "It's ridiculous," she said. "Some people don't know what to do with all of their money."
"Now that you mention it, we need money."
"I need money," she said. "You're loaded."
"I'm rich, but I don't carry around wads of cash. I use plastic for everything. I've only got about $200 on me. What have you got?"
$10.
"We need more."
"Don't look at me," she said. "That $10 is nearly all of my liquid assets."
"We aren't going to get very far without money. But we can't use our credit cards or go to an ATM or they'll know exactly where we are. We also can't go to family or friends. The CIA will be watching them all."
"So what are we going to do?" she said. "Steal stuff from here and hawk it?"
Ian shook his head. "Pawn shops have surveillance cameras. The CIA is probably watching the pawn shops, too."
"They can't watch everything."
"They can come pretty close," Ian said. "And they probably have experts who are trying to anticipate our next move, based on their experience and detailed psychological assessments of us that they're putting together using everything they're learning about us from our school records, medical records, social media, tax returns, you name it."
"You're making that up."
"Yes, I am, but does it sound credible to you?"
"Yes," she said.
"Then let's assume I'm right," Ian said. "Everybody has some loose cash in their house, so there must be some here. We have to find it."
"I'll start looking for the money." She cut off the tape with scissors and patted the last strip down on his now silver cast. "You need to take a shower and change your clothes."
"We don't have time for that," he said.
"You can't go out in public reeking of whiskey and BO and soiled clothes you've been wearing for 2 days.
"I don't smell that bad," he said.
"You also look like a mass murderer," she said. "Anybody who sees you will scream and call the police."
"Because my hair is a little messy and I haven't shaved?
It's the grunge look. It started right here in Seattle, where mass murderer Ted Bundy killed a bunch of women and he looked like a lawyer." "That's true," she said. "But your clothes are spattered with blood, and that never creates a positive first impression." Ian looked down at himself, saw the red spots, and remembered the moist sound the poker made going into the assassin's stomach. He shivered.
Okay, you have a point.
Take off your shirt, she said. He did as he was told, working his cast back through the right sleeve. It wasn't easy getting shirts on and off with his arm bent at a 90-degree angle and encased in plaster, and now duct tape, too. Margot went to another cabinet and pulled out two hefty trash bags. She stuffed his stained shirt into one of the bags and pulled the other one over his cast, then used the duct tape to tape it closed at his shoulder. "Now you can shower," she said. "Take the bag off when you're done."
"You've had experience with this."
"I broke both of my arms when I was a kid," she said. "I sucked at soccer."
"Soccer is played with your feet."
"Not the way I played," she said.
Ian went up to the master bathroom, which was about 1,000 square feet of marble and had a steam shower for two and a jacuzzi for six that was fed by a waterfall.
He undressed, stuffed his underwear, pants, and socks in the hefty bag, and took a shower at the hottest temperature he could stand. As hot as it was, he started shivering again. He'd killed a person tonight. It wasn't guilt over taking a life that shook him up, and it wasn't because he was afraid of consequences he might face. It was the realization that he was something he wasn't before. Before he was a screenwriter and an author, now he was also a killer. It wasn't something he'd trained for or expected. It was something that happened to him, something that changed him. He was shaking like a butterfly emerging from its cocoon. How it had changed him was something he didn't know yet and didn't have the time to worry about. Right now he had to keep looking ahead, not backward or inward. Steadied by his new resolve, Ian got out of the shower, removed the wet bag from his arm, gargled with Listerine, and rummaged through the man of the house's 500-square-foot closet for some fresh clothes. He quickly learned that Brooks Brothers got most of the guy's clothing business. The guy also owned several blazers with yachting, fraternity, and golf club crests on the breast pocket, which made him a douchebag. He probably owned a few cravats, too. The guy was a little taller and heavier than Ian, but if Ian tucked in the shirts and rolled up the sleeves, they fit fine, especially over his cast. He had to keep his own shoes, though, because the guy had tiny feet. Ian got dressed, stuffed some extra clothes, toiletries, and a Vicodin into an overnight bag, and lugged it and his trash bag downstairs, resisting the childish urge to slide down the huge curved railing of the grand staircase. The last thing he needed now was to break his other arm, too. He found Margot emptying a huge bag of dry dog food into a pile in the center of the living room, beside a bucket of water. The two dogs watched her but seemed bewildered, their heads cocked and their ears up. It was a crazy night for all of them. "Don't eat this all at once," she told the dogs, and then walked over to Ian. "Do you know how to crack a safe?"
"Nope," he said.
"Clint Straker would?"
"Sorry to disappoint you," he said.
"I found a big safe that's probably full of money, hidden behind a painting. But since you can't open it, we'll have to settle for this."
She led him to a table in the entry hall, where she'd placed a Costco cashew jar full of pocket change.
"I found it in the master bedroom closet, where they probably empty their pockets each night. There's probably a couple of $100 in there, and we've got this."
She picked up a leather travel wallet that was beside the jar and handed it to him.
"I found it in Mr. Barber's desk drawer."
The wallet was filled with euros, Canadian dollars, British pounds, and about 500 American dollars in $20 bills.
"Good job," Ian said. "That should hold us for a while. Now we need transportation."
Ian headed down the hall to the garage. Margot grabbed the jar of coins and followed him. The garage was immaculate, with white walls and a polished concrete floor. There were four cars for them to choose from, all gleaming like they were in a showroom. A 2017 two-door Ferrari twin-turbo 488 GTB, a 2015 four-door Porsche Panamera, a 2016 Range Rover SUV,
and a mint-condition 1968 Mustang 390 GT Fastback in Highland Green, like the one Steve McQueen drove in Bullet. The keys to the cars were on a pegboard on the wall. Margot made a beeline for the Ferrari, reconsidered, and moved to the sensible Range Rover. Ian shook his head.
Wrong choice.
It's a big, roomy car and not something flashy that will attract the police. We can even sleep in it if we have to.
I appreciate the practicality of the Range Rover, but we don't want any cars with electronics that can't be hacked or tracked. That rules out all the cars but one.
He snatched a keychain with a running pony logo on it from the pegboard and went to the Mustang. The car didn't have a single electronic component, and if it was good enough for Steve McQueen, it would be good enough for him. He popped the trunk and they stuffed their things inside. Then he went to the driver's side of the car. He was relieved to see it was an automatic transmission, not a stick, which would have been impossible for him to drive with a broken arm. It made much more sense for Margot to do the driving, especially since, technically, she was still his author escort. But he was taking charge of this operation, and she was glad to let him. It allowed him to sustain the illusion that he had a master plan, which he didn't. He was acting on panic, and some of the things that he'd learned writing cop shows and Clint Straker novels. All he knew for sure was where they were headed, but he had no idea what would happen after that. He asked Margot for directions to the seediest part of town. She told him how to get there, and he drove up and down dark alleys until he found an abandoned pickup truck sitting on blocks. He parked behind it, and at his direction, Margot swapped their license plates for the ones on the truck. Then Margot peeled off the current registration stickers from the Mustang's original plates and affixed them to the former truck plates with folded pieces of duct tape from Ian's cast. This was all done to protect their asses. Ian didn't want to get pulled over by the highway patrol for driving a stolen car or having expired plates. They tossed the hefty bag full of Ian's bloody clothes into a trash bin, and as dawn began to break on the Jet City, Ian drove onto the I-5 south. He was a man on the run, though careful not to exceed the 55 miles per hour speed limit. Chapter 21. Capitol Hill, Washington, D.C., July 19th, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. It had been a rough 40 hours or so since the seven senators last sat in this chamber and first heard about the catastrophic crash of Trans-American 976. Now they were back again, weary and anxious, to listen to a classified briefing on the situation from acting CIA Director Michael Healy, who sat alone at the witness table. Healy was a career CIA employee, recruited while he was a student at Harvard, studying foreign relations, who rose over the course of nearly two decades from analyst to deputy director. He was a Mormon and so clean-cut in appearance and lifestyle that he could have risen to the top at Disneyland, though the two jobs did have some things in common. Both were Mickey Mouse operations that took place in a world of their own. 5 weeks ago, the president had appointed Healy as the agency's acting director after his boss was forced to resign in scandal, when the Washington Post had revealed that the decorated former general, married father of four, and grandfather of two, had been having a long-term affair with the field agent's young wife. The airplane crash in Hawaii was the first major crisis Healy had to face as the man in charge, and at that moment, he would have preferred to be seating people in a bobsled for the Matterhorn ride. Senator Ramsey Holbrook, the chairman of the committee, got right to the point.
Is this an accident or another 9/11?
It's still too early to tell, Mr. Chairman, Healy said. We didn't hear any uptick in chatter about a pending terrorist attack prior to the crash, nor are we hearing anything now that points to a particular party being responsible.
What actions are you taking?
We're doing molecular-level, deep background checks on all of the passengers and crew for ties to overseas terrorist groups or foreign actors. We're also exerting intense pressure on our intelligence sources worldwide. Senator Sam Tolan sighed, releasing more indignation than air.
So you were taken completely off guard and you're still in the dark playing catch-up.
These things happen, Healy said.
Not if our intelligence agencies are doing their jobs, Tolan snapped back.
Holbrook spoke up quickly in an effort to keep Tolan, who'd made his name as a showboating prosecutor in Houston, from hijacking the briefing.
What are the NTSB, Homeland Security, and the FBI telling you about what they've learned?
Healy grimaced.
They've shut us out. They like to remind us that we're legally barred from conducting domestic intelligence activities.
You're the director of the goddamn CI fucking A, Tolan said. You should know what they know before they know it.
Senator Kelly Stowe, the liberal Californian, looked down the rostrum at Tolan.
Are you suggesting that the CIA spy on government agencies?
This is an attack on America, Senator, Tolan said. It should be all hands on deck. Interagency rivalries and petty legalities be damned.
I couldn't agree more, Healy said.
Then why the hell don't you do something about it? Tolan said.
An aide came into the chamber, approached Senator Holbrook, and whispered something in his ear. Holbrook nodded and addressed the witness.
Director Healy, I've been informed that Wilton Cross is here. He says he has urgent information for the committee and you. Do you mind if he joins us?
Yes, he most certainly did mind. Healy knew who Cross was, of course. They'd worked together when Cross was at the agency. They'd had frequent, heated disagreements over procedure. Healy thought procedure should be followed, while Cross had a more flexible interpretation, as well as more pliable ethics. Healy was glad when Cross left the agency for the private sector. So Healy dreaded what was about to come. He knew that the only reason Cross would intrude on this meeting was if he intended to stab Healy in the back, slit his throat, and shit on his corpse as he bled out. What Healy didn't know was that his imminent humiliation had actually been set in motion months before, when Blackthorn anonymously revealed his predecessor's affairs to a reporter at the Washington Post. Cross didn't want the former director, a far more experienced intelligence professional, at the helm of the CIA when Trans-American 976 went down.
It's your hearing, Mr. Chairman, Healy said, graciously bowing to the inevitable. Mr. Cross still has top secret security clearance.
The senator whispered some words to his aide, who nodded and stepped out. A moment later, Cross entered from the back of the room with Seth Barkley, who was holding a stack of files. Healy was familiar with Seth, too, since Cross had poached him from the CIA shortly after he left to run covert ops at Blackthorn. Cross joined Healy at the witness table, while Seth handed out the files to the senators. Healy shook Cross's hand and smiled with false warmth.
Good morning, Will. Sorry for barging in on you, Mike, but I thought you should hear this, too. Dramatic entrances aren't usually your style.
These are unusual times, Cross said, and handed Healy a file.
Both men sat down. Cross waited until Seth left the room before speaking.
I'll get right to it, gentlemen. We know who crashed the plane and how it was done.
There were gasps of surprise from the senators and a look of barely restrained fury from Healy, who knew that his career at the CIA was over. He not only stood zero chance of being nominated as the actual director, but now it would be impossible for him to keep his position as deputy director, too. Even so, he knew the shit had only begun to land on his corpse. He braced himself for a herd of elephants to empty their bowels on him.
I will start at the beginning, Cross said. Two Syrian Americans, Ayub Darwish and Habib Ibrahimi, were employed on the 877 assembly lines at Gordon Ganza Aviation in Long Beach, California.
The senators opened the files in front of them and saw the photos of the two Syrians. The pictures were the only items in the file that weren't complete fiction. The men's names weren't real, and although they genuinely worked at Gordon Ganza Aviation, they were recruited and employed by Blackthorn to do so. The men were both Syrian Americans, and thought they were on a covert mission for the U.S. government, installing vital surveillance equipment in commercial jets. unaware that they were actually being set up as fall guys for something much bigger.
"They both have familial ties to Harakat Harar al-Sham Islamiyah, the umbrella for multiple terrorists that are dedicated to establishing an Islamic state under strict Sharia law," Cross said. "The two men worked at Gordon Gaza for 1 year before quitting their jobs and leaving the United States for Turkey. We believe they installed devices on two or more aircraft that allow the autopilot system to be hacked by anyone with a wireless connection."
"Holy shit," Tolan said.
"You mentioned two aircraft," said Bradley Hazelton, the honorable senator from North Carolina. "What is the other one?"
"We believe the Indonesian air flight that went missing a year ago, which was also a Gordon Ganza 877 manufactured while Darwish and Ibrahimi were working on the assembly line, was crashed in the first use of the device," Cross said. "A practice run, so to speak."
Healy spoke, trying to keep his voice flat and emotionless. He was furious at Cross on a personal level, but as acting director of the CIA, his priority was resolving this crisis. So, on that level, he was thankful for the intel, assuming it was solid.
"What evidence do you have for the existence of this device?"
It was a fair question, and Cross took it that way, answering Healy with a respectful, collegial tone.
"It began with something the captain said in the cockpit voice recording from the black box."
Tolan interrupted him.
"You got the recording?"
"The transcript is in your packet."
Cross made the comment as if it were a minor detail, but the intelligence acquisition was huge and represented another headshot to Healy's career.
"The captain was convinced the plane was under the control of an outside party. He shut off all the computer systems to kill the autopilot, but not in time to save the plane."
Stowe closed the file and regarded Cross with undisguised disdain, though it looked more like he'd eaten a bad clam.
"How did you get all of this information so fast and from so many sources?"
The senator knew the answer, and so did everybody else in the chamber. But Stowe wanted Cross's actions on the record, not that anyone was actually keeping one.
"We accessed the computers at Gordon Gaza Aviation to obtain the names of all their employees, and cross-referenced them against known members of terrorist groups,"
Cross answered without the slightest hesitation.
"We also accessed U.S. Customs, the NTSB, the TSA, and numerous other public and private databases."
"You mean you hacked them?" Stowe said, as if Cross were feeding the senator a rancid meal that was making him sick.
Healy understood the tone because he was feeling the same way.
"What you did is illegal. Any evidence you acquired is tainted and inadmissible in court."
"This is not a case that will ever get to a courtroom. We both know that, Senator," Cross said. "This is about resolution and retribution."
"Damn straight," Holbrook said. "Where are these bastards now?"
"Belgium. They came across with a wave of Syrian refugees. We believe they are in a farmhouse outside of Antwerp."
In fact, he knew for certain that they were there. Both men were sedated and under guard by Blackthorn operatives, who were staging the scene and stocking it with incriminating evidence as he was speaking. Holbrook turned to Healy, who was trying to channel Mr. Spock and appear as objective and emotionless as he could, considering he was undergoing a political castration.
"Can you get them?"
"Yes, Mr. Chairman," Healy said. "We'll coordinate with our Belgian counterparts and arrange..."
Holbrook cut him off with a wave of his hand and a scowl of disgust. He turned his head and multiple chins to Cross.
"How quickly can your people do it?"
"Within the next 3 hours."
Holbrook shared glances with his fellow senators. They were all in silent agreement. Even Stowe. He fixed his gaze back on Cross.
"Do it using your men, but you've got to run the operation out of the CIA so there's no hint of private sector involvement. I'll clear it with the White House."
"That won't be a problem,"
Cross said and glanced at Healy, who nodded his consent. Not that it mattered anymore. Chapter 22. Ian drove south on a flat stretch of Interstate 5 in Oregon that was bordered on both sides by dry, weed-strewn farmland, unmarked warehouses, and rusted mobile homes. Margot was asleep in the passenger seat, her head propped against the window, the jar of coins on the floor between her feet. He liked the open road. There was something about driving, about putting his troubles in the rearview mirror and looking at a ribbon of asphalt stretching out into infinity in front of him, that cleared his head, bringing him peace and perspective. That was why whenever he was having problems in a relationship, or trouble plotting a story, he'd just get in his car and drive to San Francisco, Las Vegas, or Phoenix. He'd inevitably find the answer on the road. One of his girlfriends accused him of running away from his problems. The truth was, she resented her captive audience escaping during her most dramatic and overwrought performances. But it was the opposite. He was running toward his problems, only from a different direction. This time, however, the girlfriend would have been right. He'd killed a woman in Seattle in self-defense, and he wanted to get as far from that corpse and that memory as he could. But escaping the people who'd sent her wouldn't be nearly as simple. At least he wouldn't have to run from the police, too. He was sure the CIA would clean up the crime scene for him, not to save him from prosecution, but to serve their selfish interests. They wouldn't want the body to lead back to them or to focus any law enforcement attention on him. The last thing they wanted was the police finding him before they did, and Ian telling them what he knew, no matter how ridiculous his story would sound. So this was one instance where his interests and his enemies were the same. The Mustang hit a pothole. The bump jolted Margot awake and rattled the coins. She sat up, stretched, and rolled her head around to relieve her stiff neck. The first thing she noticed was the wretched stench from outside. That's why Ian had been breathing through his mouth for the last few miles. "We must be passing through Millersburg," she said. "Which is the best way to experience the town?" He knew she was right about where they were, because he'd seen a road sign a while back, but he didn't see anything along the road now that could qualify as a landmark. "How do you know that's where we are?" he asked. "It's known for smelling like a mountain of manure, though it's better since they closed the paper mill that used to be beside the freeway." She gestured out the window at the weed-choked foundations and parking lot that remained behind a chain-link fence. "They tore it down a few years back."
"So why does it still stink?"
"That's from the sewage treatment plant and the zirconium mining."
"Must be a lovely place to live," he said. "I guess the people get used to it after a while."
"Or everything smells and tastes like shit, and they accept it as normal because that's the price they have to pay to live at all." He gave her a look.
"I'm guessing we're not talking about Millersburg anymore."
"All I signed on for was taking you around to a couple of bookstores," she said. "Now I've got killers after me. What the hell did I do to deserve this?"
"Nothing at all."
Ian considered apologizing again, but he didn't think that would make a difference. "They're not going to stop because we killed that bitch last night," Margot said. "They're going to be even more pissed off. Next time they'll send 4 people like her, only armed with machine guns and hand grenades."
"They'll have to find us first."
"Where are we going?"
"We need to disappear. I have a friend who's been living off the grid for a while now. I'm hoping he can teach us how to do it."
"So that's it. We just run and hide."
He glanced at her. "Do you have a better idea?"
"Yeah, let's go to the FBI.
He didn't see how that was any less suicidal than going to the police, but he decided to try a different argument. "And tell them what?"
"The CIA crashed that plane into Waikiki, and it was your idea, and now they want to kill you to cover it up."
"That sounds crazy," Ian said. She turned in her seat to face him.
"It's the story you told me, and I believed it."
"Because you saw them try to kill me. You have evidence."
"There you go. We tell them how the CIA hacked a parked car and tried to..."
She stopped, hearing her own words, which didn't sound believable even to her.
"Okay, forget that. We tell them about the bitch who tried to kill us."
The woman I impaled with a fireplace poker in the ransacked house where we stole this car.
Yes, Margot said, then thought about it. Okay, forget that too. Just tell them the CIA part.
I can't prove any of it, Ian said. I don't even know the name of the guy who recruited me.
What about those three dead writers? Doesn't that prove something?
I've got no evidence that they were murdered.
They've tried three times to kill you.
Or I'm accident prone on top of having paranoid delusions, he said.
So that's it. They win. We run and hide.
Ian nodded. And we hope they never find us.
That's no life.
It's better than death, he said.
Welcome to fucking Millersburg.
Langley, Virginia, July 19th, 4:47 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Situation Room at the Central Intelligence Agency wasn't nearly as high-tech as the one at Blackthorne's headquarters. The concept and general layout were the same, but the equipment was older and placed in consoles that looked like they dated back to the Cold War. Where Blackthorne had a media wall, the CIA had a collection of monitors that reminded Cross of a sports bar. He was greeted like an old friend by the agents in the room, their reaction falling just short of applause, probably because of the cold expression on Healy's face. Manning the command console was Norman Kelton, who'd been Cross's right hand for years but was too fiercely loyal to the agency to join him at Blackthorne. Now Kelton had his old job. Kelton never ran an operation without a pipe in his mouth, and he had one today. Cross suspected that eating, drinking, and cunnilingus were the only things Kelton did without the pipe. Kelton rose from his creaking leather office chair.
"Hey, Will, did you come back for your chair?"
Cross shook his old friend's hand.
"You can keep it, Norm."
Kelton gestured to the array of screens on the wall.
"Your boys are in position and moving in."
The center screen displayed a satellite camera view that showed infrared images of several figures moving through a field toward a farmhouse from multiple directions. Two heat signatures were visible in the farmhouse. A satellite was the one toy that Blackthorne didn't have. Healy was irritated by what he saw.
"You had your people on the ground in Belgium before you walked into the Senate chamber."
"You say that like preparation is a bad thing," Cross said.
"Do the Belgians know anything about this operation?"
"We'll send them a fruit basket once we have Ayub Darwish and Habib Ibrahimi under interrogation in our safe house in France."
Cross didn't bother to disguise his irritation. He turned to Kelton.
"Why aren't I seeing clear visuals from the helmet cams? It's just static."
"Bad uplink. Could be 100 reasons for it," Kelton said. "But I bet it's because your high-end tech is incompatible with our Reagan-era satellites."
His bet was wrong. The reason was that the signal from the helmet cameras was being intentionally distorted at the source. Cross didn't want the CIA seeing anything clearly, since the entire scene was staged. This was going to be a radio play accompanied by some entertaining graphics. Being back here again, for the first time since he'd left several years ago, made him realize that he should have walked away from the CIA a lot sooner than he did. He'd stayed at the CIA through several presidential administrations and the various agency directors as an anonymous, essential cog in the machine because he loved the game of espionage and the global stakes. He believed that America's strength as a superpower depended on the decisions it made economically, militarily, and diplomatically. The success of those decisions depended on the quality of information gathered by the government's intelligence agencies. There had always been big money to be made in corporate espionage or private security, but he hadn't been interested. He'd overseen operations to topple governments, assassinate dictators, infiltrate foreign spy networks, kidnap terrorists, and sabotage enemy weapons systems. He couldn't get excited about protecting some high-flying CEO, stealing the recipe for Kentucky Fried Chicken, or sabotaging the launch of a new smartphone. The corporate stakes were mostly financial and rarely lethal.
Nobody would kill for the design of the new Camry or die to keep it secret. So where was the fun or challenge in that? But all that changed after 9/11. That was when the Pentagon began outsourcing some of their all-out war against terror to the private sector.